Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, May 13th, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Today on the show, we're talking about a corner of the American healthcare system that almost all of us have some experience with, the emergency room.
Yeah.
You've been to the ER?
I have.
I've been to the ER.
Mm-hmm.
For ourselves, for others, you know, it can be a pretty harrowing experience.
Yes.
Obviously, it's a tough job, but recently it's become tougher because ERs have become more crowded across the country. And we could be headed toward what they call a boarding crisis in American hospitals. We're going to explain why with a couple of great experts, both of whom have worked in ERs. And we're going to explore the issue kind of holistically today. We'll talk about this boarding issue. We'll also just talk about how ERs work, because it seems a little bit like a black box when you're there, right?
Yeah, you never know what's going
where
on
am
back
I,
there.
Where am I in the line? Mm-hmm. Am I getting admitted? If I'm admitted, am I going to the regular hospital at some point? You know, it's a little bit confusing, and so we can demystify some of that today on the show. This is a great opportunity for listener comments, this show.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your experience with the ER. What do you want to know about how the ER works? What are your questions for our doctors? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. If you are watching on Facebook or YouTube, drop a comment in the chat. And we should admit that this show was a little bit inspired by the popularity of The Pitt.
Yeah, I love The Pitt. I've watched,
I've
caught up. I've watched all the episodes.
Who's your favorite character?
I love Dr. Robbie because he's so real.
Yeah, it's the obvious answer, but it's still honest to you.
I really like him a lot. And there was one character, she wasn't on the second episode.
Spoiler alert.
Anyway, but we'd love to hear from you again, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And so now we have our trio of news stories.
Let's trio it up.
Some Philadelphia City Council members and local activists are hoping to put the brakes on Waymo as the driverless taxi company eyes the end of this year for its official launch in Philadelphia. Waymo has been testing its autonomous taxis in the city since last summer, and the cars have been operating with special drivers behind the wheel. The company had been working through PennDOT and PPA regarding that testing, but now these city council members like Nina Ahmad, Jim Harity, religious leaders and rideshare drivers, they formed this coalition and they're asking a lot of questions about the safety of the taxis and potential job losses. And by the way, the taxis have made the news recently because in Atlanta, multiple taxis got stuck at a blinking red light and backed up traffic. There's also been a lot of confusion. If they see hazard lights or other things, the cars get confused and they'll stop working. And so city council had a hearing about Waymo. They presented public testimony. But in reality, Avi, they have little power because PennDOT
regulates Waymo.
Regulates Waymo under a law. And so Waymo didn't even show up to, they presented no testimony at the hearing.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know exactly what the safety concerns are that council has, but all of the available public data, which, to be fair, comes from Waymo itself, suggests that these vessels are far safer than human-operated vehicles. And so if you're concerned about the safety, I would say, A, do you think Waymo's lying about that data? If so, why? If you don't think they're lying, then what's the trade-off we're making here? You have something that's safer, and you want to maybe ban it or slow it down to do what? To save some people's jobs? Is that the trade-off that you're proposing that we make as a city? And they're just proposing it. They have no power to actually do it. But, you know, if you're talking about a technology that could save people from serious harm and death, like, and you want to stop it from proliferating, like, you got to have a very good reason in my mind.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I feel like it's like people versus big tech. And, you know, I remember...
Well, people are always reflexively against change and technological change. And I understand
it's very
scary. And
they weren't specific. Yeah. You're like you said, though, they were not specific about the safety concerns. So
I'm just curious what they are.
Yeah.
Because the data that we have that's available suggests that they just are safer.
Yeah. And I think the knee-jerk reaction is to say no. But I mean, I think they, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, I think they were looking to see if they could extract some kind of wins for the community from Waymo. But when you have no power because state law preempts you, I don't know what your leverage is.
Yeah, you don't have any.
Yeah, zero.
Yeah. Okay, story number two.
Yeah.
is Amazon trying to knock off Philly-based GoPuff and steal its throne as the king of instant delivery? Interesting story on this topic from the Philadelphia Business Journal. Amazon has just launched a service called Amazon Now in 4 markets. One of them, very notably, is Philadelphia. Amazon Now sounds a lot like GoPuff. Mm-hmm. They promise to deliver groceries and household items in 30 minutes. That's kind of GoPuff's thing. They've been doing rapid delivery since 2013. They were founded by a couple of Drexel guys, still headquartered here in Philadelphia. They're in 1,000 cities across the U.S. and the U.K. So why is Amazon creating a rival service? Instant delivery is one way to hook customers, give them another perk if they're a Prime member. It also, you might note, it makes someone less likely to visit a brick and mortar store like Walmart, which is a main competitor of Amazon. Yeah. If you can give them very, very quick delivery, that can maybe cut down on their like quick trips to a brick and mortar store. So you could see the angle there for Amazon. Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like Amazon has so much money now. They're just playing around the edges to see where they could expand and who they could take out.
I think that's true.
And,
yes.
And apparently it's part of their strategy. It's part of their strategy, and they tend to fail quite a bit. Remember Amazon Fresh launched and failed within just 5 years. They didn't even last 6 months in Philly.
They were grocery stores.
Yeah, grocery stores. And I did some research, and there's a long list of other failures, like the Amazon Dash buttons. Uh-huh. It was you could order these Wi-Fi connected buttons, push it, and reorder products. That crashed and burned. they also had Amazon Care for telehealth, crashed and burned. And then Amazon had Fire Phone, which launched and failed in just a number of months, and their plan was to take on mobile phones.
Right.
But you were supposed to order your products on the phone, and people were like, nah, man, I'm not doing that.
So you think they're going to fail in their effort to unseat GoPuff?
I mean, I'm going to be Philly over everybody else, so I'm going to go for GoPuff.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think what you're describing is exactly what their business model is.
Yeah,
I mean,
try and fail.
They try and fail constantly, and when they do fail, they pull the plug very quickly. This is I think it's always been their thing.
Yeah.
And you're right, they have the capital to invest in these little trials, and they're constantly doing it, testing, is this market a market that we can capture? Is this market a market that we can capture? And it's totally not surprising to me that this is an area where they think they could break in, because they do have some of the infrastructure, right? They do delivery.
They have all the logistical stuff set up. Yeah.
And so it makes perfect sense to me that this is an area where they could think maybe we could develop a market advantage over GoPuff or Instacart or Uber Eats or DoorDash or whomever.
Yeah. I'll be watching, though, but I'm going to go for the little engine that is GoPuff, even though they have 1,000 locations.
Puff, 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 puff. By the way, it's called GoPuff.
GoPuff, sorry.
Not because of the little engine that could, but because I believe their original business was delivering hookahs.
Oh, there it is. There it is.
I guess support your local stoners. Go with GoPuff.
GoPuff. All right, third story. Now, if you're driving around City Hall, you may notice that Dilworth Plaza has a new attraction, a statue of a man leaning on a golf club wearing a real pair of navy blue golf shorts. Yeah, the man in question is the late Forrest Fesler, a pro golfer, PGA Tour winner, and a golf course designer, most known for being the first and only guy to wear shorts during a professional golf tournament.
What a
hero.
And
if you're watching, look at those kneecaps.
Ooh, baby.
He'd had leg day for sure.
Thunder thighs.
Fesler, whose nickname was Fuzzy due to his wispy hair and stash, decided to change into shorts to finish his final round in the 1983 U.S. Open in Western PA, all to protest the strict dress code that made pants mandatory even when it's sweltering outside.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, and I should say, Fesler is not from Philly, but Adidas has named him a brand ambassador, and they believe he possesses the Philadelphia rebel rouser spirit, which makes Philly the perfect place for his temporary statue.
I agree with that, yeah.
And it's also to celebrate the 2026 PGA Championship, which will kick off in Delco on Thursday. So if you want to see this statue of a man with real shorts, and I wonder how they got those shorts on him.
What do you mean? What do you mean? How did the statue?
Like, is it Velcro on the backside? Like,
someone
I don't
just
know.
Sewed it up, maybe.
Or sewed it? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good point.
But his shorts were shorter in real life.
Yeah, by the way.
Those come to the kneecaps. His were like mid thigh.
I find this story very distressing. Honestly,
why?
Because I didn't know you could get a statue for dressing down. And that's the only way I was ever going to get a statue.
I'll be like, this is...
that would have been my angle.
You
that
never know. Been my There's thing. Still time. There's still
no,
time.
No, this guy beat me to it. I mean, salute to him. He's a dressed down king.
But that statue's going to be gone in a few days. I mean, yours could be forever
no,
one day.
No, it had to
know.
Be a novelty. I think it's over for me. I've been wearing t-shirts my whole life.
But he didn't have a t-shirt. Now, that's a whole new thing.
You know, it's still a rule, by the way. You have to wear pants.
Even when it's hot.
That's wild. Mm-hmm. There are very dressy shorts.
Is that safe? I don't know.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I feel bad for the golf.
Let your legs be free.
Let your legs be free just like your swing. Yeah,
I know. Ooh, that's good. That's a little...
I don't know. That would be my pitch to the PGA. Not that they care what I think. Mm-hmm. We care what you think, actually, about emergency room medicine. That is our topic today. Get your calls in, 888-477-9499.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The hit HBO series, The Pit, can be gory. There's impalements, amputations, and flesh-eating infections. But according to experts, one of the most disturbing conditions in Dr. Robbie's emergency department is all too realistic.
As you can see, our house is always packed. And our department is mostly clogged up with boarders. Those are admitted patients waiting for a room upstairs, sometimes for days. Beds are a very precious commodity around here, so please be quick and efficient with your workups. What else? We treat the sicker patients back here, but please keep your eye on that waiting room. Make sure nobody's going to die out there.
Yeah, research predicts that the U.S. could face a critical hospital bed shortage by 2032. So today, we're talking about the boarding crisis facing American hospitals. What happened to all the urgency in the emergency department, and is there a cure for chronic overcrowding?
With us to talk about all this today, we have two highly qualified guests. Dr. Austin Killaru is an emergency room doctor, health services researcher, and an assistant professor at Penn's Perelman School of Medicine. Dr. Killaru, thank you so much for being here on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, senior contributing editor at KFF Health News and author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. She was an ER doctor in New York City before a career change to journalism. Dr. Rosenthal, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, and we'd love to hear from you, our listeners, today. Our questions are asking you to tell us about your experience with the ER and what do you want to know about how it works? We have two experts here. This is your chance to get your questions in. The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube streamers, you can leave those comments and questions in the live chat.
You know, we want to get to like the big picture crisis, if that's what you want to call it, a little later in the show. But Dr. Killaru, I would just love to demystify a little bit how the ER works. Like if I walk in as a patient, let's say with a little bit of chest pain, like what are the people who are receiving me looking for? And then how am I like sorted and queued from there? Because I think a lot of people go to the ER and they're like, wait, am I at the top of the list, the bottom of the list? Where am I and why? Mm-hmm. So give us some of like the tenets of how you guys triage a situation like that.
Yeah, that's a great question. So that's really our number one responsibility, is to sort and triage everyone that comes in. And that's our job, is to take care of every single person who crosses our door. So a lot of things go into that initial sorting process. When you come into the ED, you usually give the staff your name, and then you're seen quickly by a triage nurse.
Yeah.
The nurse will ask some questions about, you know, what brought you in, take some like vital sign measurements like your blood pressure and your heart rate, and make a kind of a quick determination of how sick you are.
Yeah. And what exactly are they looking for in that moment to kind of make like the snap call at the top?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're looking for stability. So if a person has severe trouble breathing and their oxygen levels are low, or they've passed out and their blood pressure is very low, that's a patient that we're immediately concerned about, and we get that patient in immediately. There's also certain conditions like strokes, heart attack, other things like a major traumatic injury. You know, those are patients that kind of rise to the very top of the queue. But we see a lot of other people where that decision is actually a little bit harder.
Yeah, a lot of gray area, right?
Exactly. There's a lot of gray area. And we need testing. We need, you know, to collect some blood tests. We need to do things like an EKG or x-rays to really determine how sick they are. And so those patients go into that kind of gray zone.
And so once you go to, they rank you. I don't know if there's a number system or whatever. Then you kind of sit and wait. And some people get brought back immediately. And once you get back there, though, what happens behind the curtain or behind that little door that you buzz through?
So, once a patient has come into the waiting room, they are our responsibility. So, okay. It may feel like you're sitting out there, but it still is our job, the physicians, nurses, and the whole team, to still take care of you. So we will be following, if you've been seen by the triage nurse or the triage, sometimes there's also a physician in triage. If you've been seen by those clinicians, you'll have some tests pending, and we'll keep an eye out for those results while you're still waiting. And we can, if we find something really concerning, then we can kind of rush you back. We are working in the ER to make as much space as possible to see everyone that we can in the waiting room. But that process can be really slow for some of the reasons that we're going to be talking about today in terms of reporting.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. Here's a comment from Victor on Facebook. Said, there was recently an 8-hour wait at Lankanaw in the ER. Mm-hmm. I thought people were joking or exaggerating. Then I went up to the desk and they confirmed there were more than a few people who had been there waiting for 8 hours. So, Dr. Rosenthal, how does a situation like that happen? I know you can't specifically comment on this one hospital in the Philadelphia region, but how do you end up in a situation where you have long wait times at an ER? What has usually sort of preceded that?
Well, it's kind of a fall-on effect. I mean, what we see now is this problem with boarding, which is kind of an undercurrent of the PIT in all episodes. And what that means is people who are admitted to the hospital who don't get a bed upstairs on a real ward for days. And so they kind of clog up the ER and make it harder for the ER doctors to do their job and see new patients. Because even though these people are admitted, the ER doctors, they may have a team upstairs who's assigned to care for them, but the ER docs are there and nurses. And if they crash, if they say, I can't breathe, who's there to deal with it? And I recently wrote an article for The Atlantic about my husband who passed away from esophageal cancer. He was in the emergency room for days, lying on a stretcher. So there are two sides of this. There's the physicians can't treat new patients. They're harried. They're responsible for all these other people. And for poor patients, they're lying on a stretcher, no bathrooms, no one really taking care of them. It kind of feels like you're abandoned if you're a boarder in the ER.
Mm. Yeah. And I'm sorry for the loss of your husband, Elizabeth. I want to bring in a caller. We have Patty from Springfield on the line. Patty, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My husband had a recurrent, very serious leg infection. And there was one time when we were at the hospital, also Lankanaw, coincidentally, in the infectious disease doctor's office. And he sent us to the emergency room because he said if we went to the emergency room, we could get all the tests done that he needed results from to make judgments about my husband's treatment. Mm-hmm. And if we had to schedule them on our own, it might be weeks before we were able to get him in for the various tests that he needed.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to say that because obviously that's contributing to how many people are in the emergency room and what and the seriousness of what's being treated there.
Yeah, thank you so much, Patty, from Springfield. Really interesting. And that was going to be my follow-up to you, Elizabeth, because you talked about the boarding. We've talked about the volume of people that come in. But what are some of the contributing factors for so many people seeking out emergency room care? And I asked you with this caveat because I thought urgent care were supposed to be, quick fix for a lot of people, but it seems like ERs are getting all the patients.
Well, I mean, there's been a whole change in mindset in the entire system where there are fewer hospital beds. Most emergency rooms. When I was an ER doctor, and I'm going to sound like a dinosaur, we ran an urgent care center, so people would be triaged to urgent care. Now, that's kind of outsourced to these mostly private doc-in-a-box places that they don't communicate with your real doctor. So all these people are turning up in the ER with smaller complaints who kind of have nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
And of course, they're kind of push and pull factors.
Yeah.
They've turned emergency rooms into nightmares for patients and for the work there.
And Austin, I see you nodding. You want to add something to this?
It's a very common scenario that the caller is telling us. Yeah, it's there's ERs are capable of a lot of amazing things. We can do testing very quickly. We can call specialists and consultants to see patients quickly. And so we've kind of become the entry point. If you have a urgent or even semi-urgent problem, a lot of patients are sent to us to be seen because we can handle that. It's been seen that we can handle that problem quickly. But what it has meant is that patients will now wait for hours and hours because we are just struggling to take on all of that load.
Right. Because what the caller, I think, was describing is this cascade effect of, like, the patient needs a test. The doctor is sitting there trying to solve their problem today and saying, well, you could try to schedule it, but the scheduling system's really backed up. It's going to take a while. Why don't you just walk into the ER and we can get some answers quickly. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem somewhere else in the healthcare system. The lack of testing capacity, I suppose, then turning into an ER patient. Do I have that right? And that's pretty common, Dr. Killerer?
That is. Yeah, really? That is common. And I would say that, you know, the real causes of boarding are not really anything that's happening in the ED itself.
Right.
We're doing everything we can to see patients as quickly as possible and get people through. But the problems are really the number of patients coming in, so the patients going through, and also the patients leaving the ED. And Elizabeth mentioned this, but all of our beds are usually filled with patients that are waiting for an inpatient bed. So patients that we've decided they need to be hospitalized for 2 to 3 to 4 days, and they're waiting to go upstairs. But because upstairs is full, we can't actually have them leave the ED. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is the downstream effect is that blocks people that are sitting in the waiting room from being seen by us.
Yeah. And we want to remind folks of our question this hour. Tell us about your experience with the ER. What do you want to know about how the ER works? Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. And there are a couple comments here that I think are kind of related.
Yeah.
Kate from New Jersey says, I waited 12 hours at a good hospital when I had a tiny piece of glass in my hand. Pay the doctors more money. Go back to when before corporations got involved and tie their hands. And then Judy says, why don't the EDs have another unit for almost emergency situations? Why do EDs always seem understaffed? I think those kind of fit together, Austin. Like they're both talking about the situations where it's clearly not life-threatening, but you end up in the sort of the same pipeline as everybody who has these really urgent needs. It's like you've got a problem that needs to be solved. It's not going to end your life. And you're kind of stuck in the same throughput system as everybody else. Why does it work that way? Is there just sort of no other way to do it?
Well, most EDs actually do have something called a fast track or kind of urgent care-like area. And so that initial nurse or doctor that's seeing you at the door, if they decide, okay, it's a piece of glass or an ankle sprain, then we can sometimes handle that in kind of our fast track acuity area. But that may not be available all the time. And sometimes even that becomes full. You know, we try to do our best to sort out, again, the most critical patients. Those patients that are having a stroke, and those are the patients that they, you know, if there's an available bed, they have to take that bed because their life depends on it. The lower acuity folks, you know, a cut or glass and, you know, something like that, they can be seen quickly too. But again, it's that big gray zone in the middle that they kind of have to wait.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, Elizabeth, bring you back into the conversation and piggyback on something that Austin started to touch on. That is the ripple effect from the ED to other parts of the hospital. I mean, could you talk about how the emergency department sort of connects to other departments and how it either can cause problems with the ED or the ED can cause problems with other parts of the hospital?
Well, you know, I was an ER doctor, so I think the hospital causes problems for the ED.
And how so? Yeah, yeah.
It's the way we think about hospital finances these days. Mm-hmm. So when I was an ER doctor, there were always, you know, hospitals ran at 95% capacity, so there were always some beds. But now that hospitals run like businesses, they run like airlines. You want to be 100% full all the time. And if people have to wait in the emergency room for 4 days, well, I could see from my husband's bill, that's counted as an inpatient day. So you're getting paid for that anyway. Mm. So I think that's been a big, big driver of this. I mean, also, 30 years ago, they would cancel elective admissions if they needed, if didn't have enough beds. Now the elective admissions, which are cardiac catheterizations, knee and hip replacements. Those are the big bucks procedures. So you want beds filled with those people. Mm-hmm. What you don't want beds filled with are the old people, the sicker people, people like my husband who had stage 4 cancer, because they're going to linger in those beds. They don't generate revenue. They'll be hard. And this is another.
It almost sounds like a restaurant trying to turn over tables. Yeah. I mean, that's the
to get the high earners in, so to speak.
Well, I think, and the big problem, which we haven't talked about, is there's a huge shortage of rehab beds in this country. Mm. So once you have one of those older, sicker patients there, you're going to have a really hard time getting them out. And P.S., their insurance may say, oh, no, not that rehab, even if they have beds there.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a huge puzzle, and it all ends up, being solved or not solved very well in the ED.
Yeah. And I wonder, my quick follow up to you, Austin, is this. I mean, if you have all these different pieces, and I wonder, is your budget reflected? You know, when you were an ER doc, I don't know if you're people as an administrator, do budgets and emergency departments typically reflect the volume so that you have the staffing, so that you have the supplies, so that you have all the things, given the fact that the other parts of the hospital are overbooked and the ED is stuck with all these extra patients?
It's a great question. You know, I think that chronically around the country, ERs are somewhat understaffed. You know, we could certainly benefit from more nurses, more doctors, more nurse practitioners. I think that, ERs are not, as Elizabeth mentioned, we're not the high revenue generating part of the hospital, right? Mm-hmm. That's the operating room, taking care of patients with surgeries and other things like that. And so, our patients, when they need to be admitted, they may not necessarily go to the front of the queue in terms of getting the beds upstairs. So even if we have the resources to do what we need to do in the emergency department, it really is the other parts of the hospital where those delays are the things that are obstructing
us. Keeps the jam.
Yeah. Let me bring in another caller. This is Michael from Wallingford. By the way, our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. We'd love to hear your experience with the emergency department. Mm-hmm. What do you want to know about how the emergency departments work in this country? Okay, Michael from Wallingford, you're on the line. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, thank you. I hear your guests speaking a lot about capacity in the hospitals and waiting for rooms and having to rely on other parts of the hospital. I have an elderly mother. She's fallen and broken both hips. We've been to the hospital multiple times where she's needed to be admitted. We wait for hours and hours and told we're waiting for a bed. But then when we get up to the floor where there is the bed, we walk past room after room that is unoccupied. And it's clear that maybe we're waiting for a bed, but there are plenty of rooms available. Again, that's happened multiple times. So I'm wondering, is it really a question of whether there are rooms and space available, or is it staffing to prepare the rooms for people to come up, or equipment shortages? But it does seem like when you get to the floors in these hospitals that there are vacant rooms, clearly, when you're brought up, but you've been told you've been waiting for a bed for hours.
Hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Sending healing vibes to Michael, to your mom. But yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious if you could address what Michael's seen. Maybe that's just abnormal, or maybe it does speak to this thing that we've been talking about. Elizabeth Rosenthal, your thoughts.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a great question. There are 20% fewer hospital beds than there were before the pandemic now. A hospital bed, it's not just the bed, it's the nursing staff, it's the, the nursing aides. And so, during the pandemic, and for some good reasons, a lot of things moved to the outpatient setting, hospitals closed down beds. And the other thing that happened during the pandemic is salaries for nursing staff, for PAs, everything went way up. Mm-hmm. And so the hospitals have chosen basically to operate with fewer beds. So there are beds up there. It's just that they're not staffed and licensed.
Yeah. So when we say the word bed, we're not necessarily talking about a physical bed or room. Like you say, we're talking about a room with a bed and with someone to staff it. Of course, you need all of those things to send someone out of a boarding, right? I imagine, Dr. Killerow. Yeah.
That's correct. And, you know, sometimes there's patients that may be in the operating room, you know, receiving surgery actively, and that bed may be being held for them because right. once they leave the operating room, they have to also go somewhere.
Or they're getting testing, or they're just in another
empty,
part of the hospital.
It might look empty, mm-hmm. but there's someone who's scheduled to come there, and there's that dynamic as well.
That's correct.
Yeah. Rick from Boyertown had a question who says, I'm curious why walk-ins are lower on the queue when an ambulance comes in. Is that true, Dr. Killaroo? How do ambulances weigh in to the triage categories and things like that?
That's a great question, and one that I get from patients a lot of the time. I would say that we actually kind of triage patients the same, regardless of whether they came in via an ambulance or mm-hmm. just walked into the ER. The issue is that the sicker patients are more often on an ambulance.
Tend to be.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So someone who's in a major, you know, car accident and has, you know, like, you know, a major injury. Yes, that patient's going to come in on an ambulance and probably get seen almost immediately. So, mm-hmm. You know, there isn't really a special preference. Sometimes we actually will see patients that have come in on an ambulance, you know, make sure they're okay. And then that patient actually may also have to wait hours in the waiting room, yeah. even if they've been brought yeah. in.
I wonder how, you know, we have a few more minutes before the break, but I just wonder about, you know, the pipeline. You know, given all the issues that we're seeing with ERs, the overcrowding and understaffing, I would assume that, you know, when young doctors come through and they're, you know, going through the process, their residents, all these things, they look at what's going on in the ER and they're like, you know what, I don't know if I want to do this. And you work, you know, you teach young people coming through medical school.
I
Dr.
can't
Killaroo.
Imagine.
Like,
I can imagine.
I looked
doing
at the pit and I was like,
yeah, not
high
for
blood
me.
Pressure and the, you know, stress in the making. So what does the pipeline look like? And for doctors and nurses, given that you are understaffed?
Yeah, it's a question that I think all of us are asking. A few years ago, around the time of the pandemic, we actually saw for the first time in the history of my specialty, which has only really been around for about 40 years, ER doctors, you know, before 1980, weren't really a specialty.
Hmm.
But we saw a decline in the number of medical students who wanted to practice ER medicine, and that was a bit of a surprise. That's rebounded, maybe partially because of the pit and people's popularity, the show's popularity. But I think, you know, ER medicine is not for everyone. Yeah. You have to really love.
Can I ask why you do it?
Yeah.
Because for me, it's so hard to relate to, because anything with that much pressure freaks me out. So what drew you to this profession?
So many things, and I'm not great with major life decisions. But for me, I was sure within 15 minutes of stepping into an ER. I love the uncertainty. I love the when you go there to be calm and steady under pressure is something that is maybe something I think I'm good at, or you know, wanted to be good at before training. And I like the fact that we take care of everyone. So, you know, if someone comes in with a broken toe, to someone having a heart attack, you know, we're equipped and able to kind of, you know, provide that initial care.
Sounds like everyone. It's a new adventure every day. Like,
correct.
You don't know what's going to come through the door.
Yes. You never know what's going to happen on a shift. It could be, you know, a regular shift. And then you show up, you feel like you've got it down, you know how to treat everyone, and then you have a shift that is a total mess.
So we're coming up on a break, but we have a comment and a call that are related. So Deshaun from Lafayette Hill, stay on the line. We're getting to you on the other side of this break. And both of these, I think, comments are going to get us into this conversation of what are the consequences of having people who either can't get treatment in the ER because it's too crowded, or they stay there too long. What are the health consequences of that? And then how does it ripple like through the whole system? Because we're talking about a situation that you know, might not be great for patients in the long run. If they either can't get seen or they're seen and it's not ideal, they might have health complications down the road. So Deshaun, hang on and keep those calls coming. 888-347-9499. Our studio 2 at WHYY.org is the email address. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're talking about the pressures on and problems with American hospital emergency rooms. Avi and I have been joined by Dr. Austin Killaroo, an ER doctor, researcher, and an assistant professor at Penn's Perelman School of Medicine, and Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, a former ER doc who is now a senior contributing editor at KFF Health News.
We'd love to hear from you this hour. Tell us about your experience with the ER. What do you want to know about how the ER works? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email studio2@whyy.org. I want to read this comment from CM, who says, in 2023, I went to the emergency room for non-emergency medical issue that needed attention. I was there for more than 8 hours. No food offered or provided. I eventually left on my own due to lack of care. I want to now bring in Deshaun from Lafayette Hill, who is on the line and I think maybe has like a similar experience. So Deshaun, would love to hear your question or comment.
Hi. First off, I love the show. But recently, I traveled out of state, ended up getting sick, contacting my nurse line, and they told me to go to an ER. After about 3 hours in the ER of being triaged once, called by triage three times, I was not seen. No one physically assessed me. They took some blood, some urine. I never got the results. At some point during that three-hour period, my symptoms eased up, and I decided to just take my chances. But it was very clear that the hospital was inundated with patients. When I finally got to the bed, I saw patients lining the walls. So in those cases, when a ER is clearly inundated and may not be able to provide care in a timely manner, what happens and why don't they maybe send somebody to the next closest ER or urgent care?
Ooh, good question, Deshaun. All right.
So Elizabeth Rosenthal, would love to get your perspective on, first of all, both those comments. And then could we also like move it into that conversation as well of like, if people are going to the ER and then leaving, what are like the consequences on Americans' health? Because I imagine that could be a problem for some people. It's possible they should have stayed. But I guess also answer Deshaun's question about like maybe why people aren't shunted to another hospital.
Well, hospitals don't want to turn away business, right? So there used to be a widely used thing called diversion. When I was an ER attending, you know, I could say, the hospital's too backed up. We don't have beds. We don't have space. We're going on diversion, meaning no new ambulances come to us. That's not used as much anymore because you don't want to turn away business. But I think the other thing is, people don't, in terms of the waits and people leaving, people don't have primary care doctors anymore who are available over the weekend. So they often have small things that they go to the ER for. They don't get seen, or they wait 8 hours, they don't get seen. And P.S., you know, since we also do something called Bill of the Month at KFF Health News, once they're triaged, they often get an ER bill. Even if they walk out. So, this is like a buyer beware situation. You don't get good health care and you get a bill.
Why don't people have primary care doctors anymore? What's the source of that problem, Dr. Rosenthal?
There's a great shortage of primary care doctors in this country. It's one of the lowest paid specialties. Fewer and fewer people are going into it. It's a big national, most good health systems are like a pyramid with the primary care doctors on the bottom. And we just don't have the bottom of the pyramid. So things end up in the ED. It really shouldn't have to.
Yeah. By the way, we want to hear from you. Tell us about your experience with the ER. What do you want to know about how the ER works? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook or YouTubers, you can keep those comments coming in the chat. David on YouTube says, our healthcare system needs a reset button. And I want to bring in another caller. We have Jamarcy from Royersford on the line. Jamarcy, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. So my comment is just another facet of the ER and how it functions or doesn't function. I'm an ER night physician, which is a totally different animal than a day physician because we're open. And I think some people just come into the ER because we're open. They're hungry. Yeah. They're homeless. They're tired. They're also sick. So that adds another layer of complication because now you have a lot of not sick people who are there for a lot of different other reasons that you still have to sort through to get to find the sick people that are there.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it's just, I think it's a sign of just the systems, not just the healthcare system, just all of the help.
You're downstream of all of society's ills is what you're describing, Jamarcy. That's a really good call.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jamarcy from Royersford on the line.
That's a great call.
A great call because, I mean, city hospitals also may be very different from suburban hospitals and some of the things they have to deal with. And this sort of like, you know, has me thinking, like, how did we get to this place, right? And was it the pandemic? Was this sort of like, were we getting here before the pandemic happened? What are the series of things that sort of pushed EDs and hospitals to a place where they're overcrowded, understaffed, and overburdened?
Yeah, I think this was happening long before the pandemic. And the issues that we've been talking about, crowding, boarding, long wait times, all of this is kind of the inevitable result of how our healthcare system has been designed. And the caller that recommended a reset button on healthcare is probably correct. That all the ways that we pay for healthcare, that hospitals are operated, that you know our primary care access, all of those things compound to lead to you needing to wait 8 hours.
And sorry to keep some of our commenters on hold here as we dig in a little further on this, but let's clarify. So hospitals, as I understand, operate on pretty thin profit margins, which is, I think, explains why they reserve a lot of these beds for these elective surgeries that generate a lot of revenue. So what would be, first of all, am I right about that, Dr. Killaroo? But then also, what would be the solution for that then? Like, say, just give hospitals more money so that they don't have to operate on thin margins? Is it make it so they're not profit motivated at all? Like, what would be the systemic fix so that they aren't keeping all these beds for the patients that the ER is essentially not serving?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've seen in our area, in Philadelphia in particular, we've seen the consequences of hospitals that are not able to break even, right? We've seen closures of Hahnemann and Chester. So the flip side of this is, you know, if a hospital is not able to survive in their
financial it just closes.
It closes, yeah. So we
which probably puts more pressure on all the remaining hospitals.
Correct.
Yeah.
And we've seen that absolutely with the closures that we've had in our region. I think there's many hard solutions that that all can make an incremental difference. There's no kind of magic, you know, solution. I think one area is just even understanding the problem. We actually don't have very high, like very visible measures right now to understand how often this is happening.
We're not even tracking ER overcrowding.
Correct.
Yeah.
And as you can, you know, as the callers are all attesting to, this is a problem that has affected almost everyone.
Yep.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is it's not something that's been prioritized as a kind of measure for, you know, at the kind of the state or the federal level in terms of, you know, regulation of healthcare. I think there are ways of paying hospitals or kind of setting up these kind of financial arrangements to help hospitals maintain more capacity.
Like incentivize them to keep some beds open, essentially.
Yes. But, you know, those are challenging to set up. You can imagine paying a hospital, instead of paying for each case that gets admitted to the hospital, you can imagine paying a hospital to take care of a population, right? And the hospital could then decide to kind of, you know, try other ways of maintaining those open beds. We often hear, oh, well, why don't you just build more beds? Mm-hmm. Well, in our current system, if you build more beds, those beds will be filled pretty quickly, right?
Yeah, because you have so many people who are waiting.
Mm-hmm.
So
then
they'll just schedule more elective surgeries, and then you'll end up, you have more beds, but no more capacity is what you're saying.
That's correct.
I'm curious, could you hop in on this, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal? What are some potential solutions so that there would be more like flex capacity in these hospitals so that they could take people out of the boarding department and like fully admit them? How could we get to that place?
Well, I think one thing that we're talking about here is we don't have a measure of ER boarding.
Yeah.
Hospitals are not required to measure it. And you can't even address a problem unless you have numbers, statistics. The Biden administration in its last days recommended that CMS create a panel to look at this problem of ER boarding. And there are plans to have them report ER boarding starting in 2028 in a required way, and maybe some Medicare penalties by 2030. But the problem is, you know, ER boarding is good for business, so how big are those penalties going to be? So I do think, you know, it's a problem with so many facets, and I think more primary care doctors would help. I tell everyone to have a primary care doctor. You know, this business where you got to get on every phone call to a doctor or a hospital, and the default is, if you don't know what to do, go to the ER. Like, that's terrible, right? It's bad advice. It's bad medicine.
It seems like the primary care, you know, practices could even have a weekend doctor or somebody on call, even on the weekends, so that, you know, the only thing open isn't the ER. By the way, I want to read a couple comments. Angela on YouTube says, it's a common myth that excess volume of, quote, urgent care type complaints are driving ED crowding. It's the admitted boarding patients that are driving the long wait times. We've been talking about that. Leave Balone on YouTube says, medical industry propaganda in the U.S. has convinced people that single payer systems have worse issues with waits, service, etc. But here we are facing it under the U.S. privatized system. I want to bring in a caller. Hope from New Jersey's on the line. Hope, you're on Studio 2. We only have a few minutes left, so if you could keep your question or comment brief, we would appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, sure. Love the show, first of all.
Thanks,
and
Hope.
Second of all, I'm a hospital social worker in New Jersey, Central Jersey. I'm not going to name where, but we only have one ER in the city I work in, and I work in a very urban city. Mm-hmm. There's no access to care for people. There's a big population of undocumented immigrants as well. They have one clinic they go to, and they all end up in the ER. And then if they have complex medical problems, they don't qualify for any type of insurance, so they end up staying in the hospital for long days, and that is another issue as well. Thank you. It goes
back to this common theme of it's downstream of all of these other sort of problems in society, people living on the margins, and they're all getting funneled into the ER.
And so this goes to my question to you, Austin. So what keeps you up at night? And I wonder, because I wonder what it's going to take. You know, we talked about solutions. You brought that up. What is it going to take, you think, to make everyone collectively, all the systems, make this a priority so that some of these solutions get actually implemented?
I'm worried. The things that keep me up at night are, you know, one, honestly, some of the people. I know a lot of people who have left our specialty or, you know, practicing the emergency department with physicians or nurses, and it's sad to see people that have, been doing this for a while and just decided it's time to try something
else.
It's
too much.
I'm worried that the problems that we've all been talking about will be getting worse, especially with the upcoming changes to Medicaid insurance and people that, you know, if people lose insurance, whether from Medicaid or something else, it's just going to compound all of these issues. And so we'll see more patients in the ER. We'll have a harder time both and getting people out of the hospital and into other places for care. And so we're on a trajectory where this problem is actually not going away, and it could actually accelerate.
Mm.
And so I think, again, these solutions are hard, but we need to take some measures to stop doing that. I think one, starting with measurement, but two, really thinking about how can we design a system to take care of people when they're sick.
Real quick, Rhiannon from Chester County is on line 3. We are almost at the end of the show, Rhiannon, so if you could keep your comment brief. You're on Studio 2.
Okay, hi. After listening to this, the one thing that I never hear on a program with this sort of a topic is the fact that people seem to feel entitled to the health care we have in this country. I think that we should all be thinking more along the lines of the fact that these doctors and nurses and so forth are just unbelievable heroes for us. I'm very athletic, so I tend to end up in emergency room and so forth from a lot of times. And people are so unpleasant to them and so demanding. And none of us have a God-given right to the incredible health care we have in this country. And so many hundreds of thousands, millions of people in the world would give their left arm
to have anything like what we have, even if you have to sit and wait for 8 hours for it.
Yes. Well, thank you for that call. That's Rhiannon from Chester County. That is the end of our program, yeah. But I learned so much this hour.
I did too.
And we had some great comments and calls. And of course, I want to thank our guests, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, senior contributing editor at KFF Health News, author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. She was an ER doctor in New York City before a career change to journalism. Dr. Rosenthal, thank you for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And Dr. Austin Killaroo, emergency room doctor, health services researcher, and an assistant professor at Penn's Perelman School of Medicine. So appreciate your time today on the program, Dr. Killaroo.
Thank you.
Yeah, Tracy says we have a busy internal medicine practice where we spend way too much time trying to get testing pre-certifications for our patients from their insurance companies. Very often there is a delay or denial, and we just need to send the patient to the ER so they can get the care that they need on a timely basis. So many reasons for the busyness in the ERs. And I have to say thank you, of course, to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Marie Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer, Al Banks, and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.